Thank you.
Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, July 12th, 2011, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Sierra. Our very special guest this evening is Robert Morningstar, a civilian intelligence analyst and psychotherapist in New York City. He's a specialist in photo interpretation, analysis, and computer imaging, and co-editor of UFO Digest magazine. And that website is www.ufodigest.com. As an FAA-licensed pilot and instrument ground instructor with more than 25 years of flying experience, Robert has had close encounters while in flight. He studied the paranormal and UFOs for over 50 years and has published many research articles on the Internet exposing government cover-up and deception. His work in the JFK assassination is cited in major books on the assassination, and he has written extensively to expose NASA's use of disinformation technology in suppressing evidence of extraterrestrial life. He's a regular lecturer at the Edgar Cayce Institute in New York, a Tai Chi and Kung Fu master. His thesis on the connection between Mars and Egypt, called The Four Faces of Mars and A Night to Remember, offers extraordinary evidence to demonstrate a direct relationship between the Giza Pyramid Complex in Egypt and a particular region of the planet Mars. We'll start on that subject and see where it leads, since Robert has so much to tell us. Starseed Radio Academy is honored to welcome him to our show. We'd like to thank Purple Sage and Tammy for hosting the chat room and switchboard tonight, and we're hoping that Tammy's electricity comes back on at some point after the storm they had last night so she can be with us. Purple Sage will be forwarding your questions to us from the chat room for those who can't call in. And if you can call, once again, our number is 917-889-8292. Then press 1 so we know you have something to say. You can also listen on your computer at blogtalkradio.com/starseed-radio-academy. As always, we ask you to be brief and please only questions or comments relating to our topic this evening. Now, before we get started, I'd like to remind you that if you'd register as a listener here at Blog Talk Radio and then click follow on our page, it would really help to get our show featured, which would help us reach more starseeds. We've had close to 43,000 listens to our show, and so far, 349 followers. So please, register for free and click the word follow on our show page. And then tell a friend. The Starseed Radio Academy team is grateful for your help. If you haven't visited our main site yet, which is starseedhotline.com, we have a lot of vital information for Starseed in our Vault of Knowledge. The entire site is coded for Starseed activation. We also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. Plus, we're on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go. We'll be getting started in just a moment, but first I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. If you'd like our Stage 1 Starseed confirmation, you'll get your natal and progress charts plus an MP3 of your reading pointing out and explaining your star markings if you have them. Our Stage 2 readings, which are a one-on-one phone consultation, do get priority and include the Starseed confirmation if you haven't had one. Both Lavendar and I are available for the Stage 2 personal consultation. And make sure that your birth info is exact to the minute and include your place of birth as well as your current residence, your current place of residence. And if any of that is missing, it'll delay your reading until we can find out. And don't forget, if you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by requesting your solar return timing. Your manifestational ability is amplified 1,000-fold during those 10 hours, So make the most of it. And now I would like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Sierra. Hello, ladies.
Well, hello, Lavendar here. Sierra, are you there?
I sure am. Hello, ladies.
Hey.
Good. Well, this is going to be a great show. I hope that that everyone has got their seatbelts ready because we're going to have quite a ride. So if you'll bring Robert on, we'll start right away.
Okay. Hang on. Here we go. Hello, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Hello.
Nice to be aboard the Starship.
Yes, this is one big starship.
I'm sure it's called Planet Earth.
Yeah, right.
Right.
So great,
Robert,
great to make contact with you.
This is Lavendar, and I'm going to start by having this interview with you, and then I'm going to share this program with Sierra and Ariel later on in the program. And so I just was, first, I'd like for you to start talking about your birth and what you remember coming into the planet, if you have any recollections of that, and maybe your early life building up to who you are now.
Actually, I have very strong recollections of my birth because I actually woke up before I was born. My mother tells me that I was a nine-month, two-week baby. I was born 2 weeks late, and I remember awakening in my mother's womb, and I was awakened by the sound of music that she used to listen to. So there I was in the womb, and I heard this marvelous sound that I would later know as music, but it was something different than the sounds that I'd been used to, which were the sounds of my mother's body, her heartbeat, the blood pumping through, burps, gurgles, etc. But music is distinct, and that awakened me. And then I also remember seeing a very bright red light, all of this before I was born. Later on, years later, I told my mother about it, and she told me, oh, when you were going to be born, I used to listen to classical music. And I said, yeah, well, what about that red light? Oh, she said, oh, that's so easy. I used to go to the beach. We used to go take the boat, go across the bay and go to the beach, and I would lift up my dress and expose my belly to the sun. So that must have been the red light that you were seeing. So I was born already eager and waiting for life, I guess. I was already alive, but waiting for whatever it was. And I do recall being in the crib and thinking I was everything. And that means I was me, I was the crib, I was the walls, I was the sky, I was everything. And as time went by, I started to realize that my sensations ended at my skin, basically. And I learned my limitations, or limits, by biting my fingers and biting my toes and hitting my hand against the crib. And then my consciousness congealed and concentrated inside my body. But before that, my consciousness was quite wide open and had no limits. And so I thought I was everything, basically. So the concentration and consolidation of identity over a period of weeks. My eyes, I remember, were not focused, and I remember that I used to recognize different people by their scent. I could recognize my mother and my family, and I could recognize strangers by their scents. And I remember some obnoxious strangers that used to approach me who smelled like cigars, which I didn't like very much. I used to squirm and try to evade those people. But I have quite a wide range of memories, including seeing a comet in the first weeks after my birth. My mother or my grandfather or both took me out into the night sky and lined up my eyesight with their arms pointing at something. And then I remember seeing this broad silver streak across the night sky. And even then, you know, less than a month old, I saw that comet, whatever that thing was different than the stars in the background or the moon. So as I was telling Lavendar, that I was born with a lunar eclipse and a comet and I'm in a Libra. So I've always tried to find balance and admire balance and equilibrium. And that's part of a good life is maintaining that first. Because if you're out of equilibrium mentally or physically, you're not going to be in equilibrium spiritually or emotionally.
Wow.
So that led me ultimately to Tai Chi, which is my chosen vocation to express all of these urges, concepts, ideas, and develop my physical skills to the highest level possible. And still getting better. 40 years of Tai Chi.
Oh, wow.
Kung Fu
so,
and Tai Chi.
So, you know, I looked at your chart today and we talked about it. And for our Starseed audience,
yes.
You have so many star markings, and most of them have to do with mastership and be able to balance out so many things and help so many people on the planet. And with a grand trine in your fire, grand trine in your chart, that really doubled up, and it was a gateway to the Great Pyramid of Giza. And that's kind of where I wanted to go now with this conversation, because
sure.
I'm very, very anxious to hear about your connection to the Great Pyramid of Giza and also your information about Mars. So let's just
sure.
take it wherever you want to take it.
Well, of course, let me get to the earliest experience that I have of the Great Pyramid of Giza. Had to do with, it was in the early 1950s, there was this little viewer that used to put little carousels of pictures that gave you a 3D view. I forgot what it was, Viewmaster, I think it was called. It was like binoculars, and you put this wheel of pictures in, and there was two pictures of each item, and so you would click and you'd go through 3D photos. This particular set was of Egypt, the Sphinx, and the Great Pyramid of Giza. So this was when I was about five, 6 years old. I couldn't get enough of those pictures, especially the 3D part, but the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid were very powerful, even to a child's mind. And throughout my life, I studied the mysteries of the pyramid and the Great Pyramid, singular. The pyramids is one mystery, but the pyramid itself, the Great Pyramid, is a mystery unto itself. I won't go over all the astronomical connections and the relationship to the mass and the size of the Earth and the division of the land mass and the oceans into halves by its position, since I'm sure that almost everyone is familiar with that. Although some people may not be familiar with the prophecies of the pyramid, which seem to be encoded in the descending passage, the ascending passage, the grand gallery, all encoding the history of mankind, the demoralization of mankind in the sense of demoralized, it became immoral, leading to the flood. And then the reclamation, the ascent, when the descending passage makes its turn, it coincides with the period in history with the receiving of the law, the Ten Commandments by Moses, and the climb is the ascent to the messianic manifestation, which was prophesied in the Great Pyramid, the coming of the Christ. So I've studied all of that, and I recommend very highly, as probably the best book on the subject of the code of the Great Pyramid. It's called Decoding the Great Pyramid, and it's by Peter Lemessurier. That book will open your eyes. It's a marvelous work, and I've read scores of books on the pyramid, but this one still stands out to me as the best one ever written. Although I do owe a lot to other books that dwelt and delved into the sacred geometry of the Great Pyramid. Well, to make a long story short, that and combined with my studies of astronomy and planetology led me in 1997 to an insight as I was studying the planet Mars and concentrating. At that time, I was working with Richard Hoagland very closely. Richard was still living in New York, and from 1993 through 97, Richard lived right across the river from Manhattan in Hoboken, New Jersey. So we used to get to see each other quite a bit and spent a lot of time brainstorming and exchanging information. And that's when my knowledge of Mars took a quantum leap, when they revealed the face on Mars and the other anomalies. I went into it very, very deeply, and also took independent routes. And I came across the mystery of Olympus Mons and this area called the Tarsus Montes, or three volcanoes. Gigantic volcanoes, but they're like the three sisters of Olympus Mons. And I'm very gratified that you were able to put some of these images on your website. I checked just before we came on, and I was hoping that we could have something that people could relate to regarding the significance of this discovery, which is that in 1997... A Night to Remember is the subtitle of the Four Faces of Mars. It was actually on the night that it was the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, I recall very, very clearly, which is why I called it A Night to Remember. And I got hit with this insight, which was that the Great Pyramid Complex of Giza, coupled with the holiest mountain in Egypt, which is called Al-Wajid, and is across to the west from the pyramid complex, there is a great depression. The lowest point in the Mediterranean area is a great depression in Egypt, which lies to the west of the pyramids and goes to the borders of Libya, where an escarpment runs like a palisades, runs all the way down and descends to the the palisade descends and the base ascends, the Qatar Basin, 450 feet below sea level. This is right in the area where Rommel's armies were defeated by the British Army in World War II. So the whole terrain has a very deep and historical Martian aspect to it. And I'm talking about Martian in the color, Martian in the mythology, and Martian in the wars that have occurred in that region since time immemorial. So what I discovered was that the Great Pyramid of Giza, the three pyramids, the Khufu complex, has a relationship to a sacred mountain which the Egyptians call Al-Wajid, which is the holiest mountain in Egypt and was the original Mount Olympus. The original Mount Olympus is not in Greece, it is in Egypt, because the Olympian gods are really transmogrifications of the Egyptian gods, who were basically downloaded into Greek culture. And the Greeks gave them different names, had the same attributes. They were they're called the Olympians, and they transposed the site of the holy mountain from Al-Wajid to a Mount Olympus, or Mount Parnassus in Greece. But the key to the proof of what I'm saying really comes in the history and the story of Alexander the Great, whose life story I've studied since childhood. And in childhood, I read The Life of Alexander the Great, and I also remember reading Classics Illustrated, which was a great, what we'd call comic book, but they were not comical. They were comic book renditions of great histories, great stories, and novels. And so Alexander the Great was one of them. And I recall very distinctly the death of Alexander, who died from a fever while in Persia, and whose body was carried back, and it was said that he had been buried on Mount Olympus, and that Alexander resided with the gods in Mount Olympus. Well, Alexander, they looked for Alexander's tomb all over Greece, 2,300 years, and they never found a bone. Yet, in 1994, in this little town called Siwa, S-I-W-A, at the foot of Al-Wajit, they found the body of Alexander the Great. And this was sitting in the back of my mind since I had followed this for 50 years. I remember that it was, you know, in mid-50s that I was reading those myths and the legends of the Greek gods, etc., and learned that fact. And then, in 1994, I was flabbergasted that they found the body of Alexander the Great buried in Siwa, Egypt, at the foot of this mountain. So during the next, 3 years or so, I continued my studies of Mars and became aware of the face on Mars and Cydonia and the sacred geometry of Mars. And then this amazing coincidence that so many of the names given to the planet Mars and its topographical features by Carl Sagan, Philip Morrison, the people at NASA and Los Alamos, that so many of them were reminiscent of Greek mythology, starting off with Olympus Mons, you know, the greatest mountain, the highest mountain, the biggest volcano in the solar system. So it starts off with that. So that night, I recall, I was contemplating Mars and also dwelling on the tragedy of the Titanic, you know. The year before, all the hoopla had been about Titanic, the movie, James Cameron, and the discovery years before of it. And yet, this was the anniversary, you know, the Academy Awards were over, they'd been given, and nobody was making a peep about the Titanic and all the people who died. And, you know, that's a significant thing in my life. So I did a meditation for hours. You know, it started around midnight because Titanic went down sometime around midnight, 12 and 2 in the morning. So I stayed up and I did Tai Chi and meditation. And you know, that whole concept, it's kind of an archetypal tragedy in the history of Western man, Western Europe and America. So many people were touched by it. That's what I was doing. So then, at about 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the morning, after the ship went down, figuratively speaking, spiritually speaking, I turned to my computer and I popped up these photographs. And all of a sudden, I found this new photograph of the Tarsus Montes and Olympus Mons and the Valles Marineris region of Mars. And all of a sudden, I had never seen one that had all of these terrain features in one shot. But I said to myself, my God, doesn't that remind me of something? And what it reminded me of was the three pyramids of Giza, the volcanoes, the Tarsus Montes. And then I said, gee, I wonder if those angles work out, the slant, the slope, you know, the relationship. So I popped open this book on pyramidology that I had, and it contained a surveyor's map of Giza made by, I believe it was Piazzi Smith, one of the great first early investigators, a British archaeologist, and his group, and they did surveying of the area. But in this particular drawing, what struck me was that the surveyor had gone to some place far removed from the pyramids, where he had a great vantage, and he could have just done his surveyor's sketch or plan of the pyramids alone, but he sought it necessary to include the Qatar Basin and Al-Wajit, but in a reduced form. That is to say, he was trying to do a surveyor's plan of the pyramids to a certain scale, but he could not maintain the same scale to include that whole vast stretch of land leading out to Libya and Al-Wajit. So he shrunk that part to be able to encompass it in his drawing. And as a result of that, I was able to see, oh my God, not only do the three pyramids correspond to the three volcanoes comprising the Tarsus Montes, but Al-Wajit stands in relationship to the Great Pyramids in the same way that Olympus Mons stands in relationship to the pyramids of Giza. That alone to me was stunning. But then it went even deeper. All of a sudden I realized, wait a second, this is right here next to the biggest canyon in the solar system, this crack in the planet Mars called the Valles Marineris, which runs for about 2,500 miles. It's like the Grand Canyon running from New York to San Diego. And then it struck me, well, you know, Giza is right next to one of the biggest cracks on the planet Earth, which is called the Great African Rift Valley. Well, that's something. Two correspondences. Then there's the Great African Rift Valley is right next to this depression, a crack in the earth that is right there under the Red Sea, and falls off into a very, very deep region of the ocean. Well, the Valles Marineris stands right next to this area called Solis Lacus, which is known as the Eye of Mars, which I saw with my own eyeballs in 2003, which is the most shocking, frightening thing that I've ever seen. I've never been frightened to the pit of my stomach as I was the night that I saw the Eye of Mars. But I'll come back to that. Alongside the Great Pyramids, running north to south, is the Nile River. So I start studying the topography of Mars, and I found that there on Mars, lying to the east of the Tarsus Mountains, is a dry riverbed called Credencia Fossa, which lies and runs north to south. So all of a sudden I said to myself, my God, it looks to me like I am seeing a terraformed model of Mars situated in Egypt. And it occurred to me that the entire mythos of the Olympian gods, the Egyptian gods, transmogrifying into the Roman gods, are really telling this one story of sky people who came down to Earth and they left a model of their homeland. Just kind of like a Japanese gardens, you know. Japanese gardens, to create this illusion of a great landscape by terraforming and gardening and modeling the garden, miniature trees, you know, rocks and settings to create the illusions of cliffs and waterfalls. Well, that's what I believe was happened in Egypt, and that it was left there as a sign and a signal to us so that one day we would awaken and arrive at a level of intelligence and insight where we would be able to look upon this and say, hey, doesn't this look familiar? And hey, look where it's pointing. It's pointing up, and there's a lot of red stone employed, red granite employed in the building of the pyramids. So what it said to me was, these are pointers. They're saying, look up in the sky, look for something red or reddish that looks kind of like this, and then go there and take a look around. And so we went by satellite, and we went there and we took a look around. And these geniuses, and Sagan was a genius, Philip Morrison was a genius, Wernher von Braun was a genius, these geniuses saw it right away because it's inescapable. So they saw it and they started naming these places on Mars: Olympus Mons, Tarsus Montes. They named one area Syria. They named another area Sinai. And this Sinai it lies due east of the three volcanoes. And the Sinai Peninsula lies due east of the three pyramids. So it seems to me that these men saw it and they said, oh my God, this is amazing, you know. This is an Olympian correlation between Mars and Earth, but this is too big. This is too much for people to handle. This would upset religion, theories of evolution. Science would be rocked. So I feel that NASA went on this debunking, lying, quashing the truth binge, and they're paying the price for it. They're being dismantled little by little, you know, because they betrayed the confidence of the American people. We paid for those journeys and for that knowledge and information, and they've treated us like children, as if we can't handle the information. But little by little, people like Richard Hoagland and Robert Bovall and Graham Hancock, all of whom are acquaintances and friends of mine, each one has been striving to bring an element, a thread of truth to the surface. And I mentioned Robert Bovall because he's got a marvelous theory, which is the theory that the pyramids are built to align themselves with the belt stars of Orion. And this is a fantastic and a wonderful theory. And I say to people, there's nothing that says that the two of us can't be right. The pyramids could be aligned with the belt stars of Orion and could also represent the Tarsus Montes volcanoes of the planet Mars. And so that was a marvelous insight, and it gave me another insight into the face on Mars. Because imagine all of this happening to me in one night. You know, this is what is staggering. All of these revelations came to me in a single night after I meditated on the hearts and souls of the people who died on the Titanic. I don't know what the connection was, except that I was in a very, very wholesome and reverent and spiritual state of mind, really caring about these people. And then I received this download, or this insight erupted from me, and I went on with the Face on Mars. And the Face on Mars I'm talking about is the 1997 oblique slant range view taken of Mars, which was posted by NASA and came out all over the media, and instantly the media started jumping on it and saying it was only a rock. Now, here's the funny part of this story. I looked at the picture when it came out in a newspaper before I saw any other news report. And I looked at it and I said, oh man, it's only a rock. Which was weird. I had a little bit of like, oh man, that's so disappointing. It's only a rock. Now that was my thought, or I thought it was my thought. So then I turn on the television and I hear the announcer say, oh folks, as you can see, it's only a rock. I change the channel and I see somebody else saying, oh, as a well-known astronomer said, you can see plainly it's only a rock. And I said to myself, wait a second. Everybody, and then every newspaper was saying it's only a rock, it's only a rock outcrop. But I thought, wait a minute, let me take a look at this picture again. So I took the picture out, and what I noticed, which bugged me from the first time I saw it, was the picture was tilted. See, it was tilted at a weird angle. And yet, at that weird angle, I was getting this unusual geometry from it. Like, you know, that left side of it is slanted in kind of the angle of the Great Pyramid, but the whole thing, the whole strip is skewed with a weird angle on the right side. So I put the picture up on the computer, I got my protractor, and I start measuring the angles, and the angle on the left side was really quite close, close to 52 degrees, which is the base angle of the Great Pyramid. But the wacky angle on the right, that one really cracked me up. When I put the protractor to the wacky angle on the right, as I call it, it came out to 19.5 degrees. And I started laughing. I said, pardon the expression, I used a very rude term. Those, you know what's at NASA, this is a dirty little joke on Richard Hoagland. How nasty can you get? You know, to fool the people into not seeing the thing, they tilted the picture, but they tilted it to 19.5 degrees, which is Richard's keystone angle for all the decoding of all the sacred geometry in Sidonia and the planet Mars and the step pyramid in Mexico and the position of the major volcanoes like the Hawaiian Islands and, 19.5 degrees is also where the great volcano in the Canary Islands is. So So this was kind of like a NASA joke on Richard Hoagland. So what I did is I rectified the picture. I straightened it out, and then I saw, you know, they really goofed. They showed too much information here, because what it showed was a slant range angle of the right side of the face on Mars, but just over the horizon, you might say, so that the left side of the face information was there, but it was foreshortened. While you saw the right side of the face long, it's like looking at a person in a three-quarter profile, like my picture there, yeah, that you have on the website. You can see the entire right side of my right side profile, but my left side falls away, so you don't see all that the details, but it's all there. So what I did is I straightened out the photograph, and then I balanced it. I stretched out the information on the left side of the face to make a symmetrical face, and that's when it hit me. My God, this looks like a lot of animals and people in here all of a sudden. So then I divided the picture and mirrored one side and mirrored the other, and what emerged were four faces. One was the face of a lioness, a female lion, which I took to be Sekhmet later. I then did a mirror image of the right side, and that came out to look like a man with a beard with a skull cap on. But he also looked like the man in the shroud, in the Shroud of Turin. I said, this is really strange. And I kept looking at it. There's something else here. There's something in my brain. I can see things that other people can't see because of my training in sacred geometry and a lot of other things I've done. But all of a sudden I said, let me turn that picture upside down. So I flipped the picture. And when I flipped the picture, it was a hawk. You've got a picture of it on your website. And all of a sudden I have a female lion, a man who looks like the dead king or King Arthur or the man in the shroud. And you flip the man in the shroud over and turns into a hawk. I go, what else have we got here? My goodness. So then something hit me, and I went back to the original picture, and instead of bisecting it at 50-50, I used the golden mean, 1.618. And that means I stretched it just just a little bit farther than the midline. And when I did that and mirrored that, I got the face of a bull. Now, those of you who know Egyptology know that the bull was a very sacred animal. There was a bull cult in Egypt that sacrificed a bull every 17 years. And there's a mythology, even among the Hebrews, the Israelis today, they're waiting for the birth of this sacred cow, certain red heifer. So all of these myths are tied in with some kind of astronomical messianic message. And here, on the face on Mars, I have decrypted information that was geometrically encoded. And what are the chances? What are the chances statistically that in one element, one reproduction, I can decipher it geometrically, divide it in half, mirror both sides, and out of it emerge the face of a lion, the face of a man, the face of a hawk or an eagle, and the face of an ox. And that struck me because those are the four symbols of the four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So what I feel we have here is the transmission of a universal symbol system that went from the planet Mars to the planet Earth, encoded, embedded, encrypted, waiting for the time when mankind advanced enough spiritually, intellectually, to look back on his own history and look at his own symbol structure to make a connection between the site and the source. So my belief is the human race really began on planet Mars, and that there was a cataclysm which destroyed the Martian ecosystem, and a remnant of this Martian civilization succeeded in coming to Earth And wherever the remnant landed, they established colonies whose first goal was to record in stone, leave markers, pointers, you might say, to teach mankind about his own true origins. So that, in a nutshell, is what the four faces of Mars refer to. And it's all tied up with the transmogrification, meaning the change in shapes and of symbols that are handed on. So, you know, in the landing of the skycraft that was seen by the prophet Ezekiel, angels step out of it, seraphim step out of the craft, and they walked on hoofed feet. And they had four wings, but each of them had a headdress, which was the face of a man, the face of an ox, the face of an eagle, and the face of a bull. So here we have the transmission of the symbols from the Hebrew tradition, from Ezekiel, and it's transferred into the Christian tradition by the adoption of those symbols by the four evangelists, and then coming the evolution of the what we call the Christian era. But all of it seems to devolve and go back to the planet Mars. So I think that those of us who feel we are Martians are awakening to that. And I've had one of those awakening experiences at the foot of the great teacher, Graham Hancock, which, if you were interested, I'll tell you about a little bit later. Do you have any questions? You want to go in any particular direction with this Martian concept?
Yeah, I'd like to go back to, what do you think the correlation was with the Titanic with you at this time? What was that about, you think?
Well, here it is. I think, and this is the first time I'm voicing this because, you know, good questions tend to act like, they spark a reaction. So I think that the tragedy of the Titanic in microcosm is an analog of the tragedy that I was yet to discover on Mars. See?
Can I ask you the date of the Titanic sinking?
Oh, yes, April 15th, 1912.
There you go. Sun at galactic degree in Aries, ruled by Mars.
Yeah, and Mars seems to be hovering over many, many... Of course, it's god of war, god of peace. But it's always around these catastrophic events. There was a conjunction of Venus and Mars in the constellation Scorpio on the day President Kennedy was killed. That's what was over Dealey Plaza at 12:30 in the afternoon, November 22nd, 1963. Along with it, as you know, the constellation Scorpio, the biggest, the greatest star in the whole known universe to us, Antares, is the star of the fallen angel. So whoever dressed up, the ritual of the assassination of President Kennedy was well aware that the constellation Scorpio was hovering over Dealey Plaza, but more importantly, that with the transit of Venus and Mars through Scorpio that very day, astronomically, it replicated the date of the assassination of Osiris by his evil twin, Seth, which I have discovered is the first assassination in history, and actually history begins with assassination, and that's the assassination of Osiris. Well, I have a book called Echoes of the Ancient Skies, and in that book it says Osiris was slain when Mars was moving through the constellation Scorpio. So the death of President Kennedy was ritualized and dressed up in a religious panoply to kind of echo the assassination of Osiris by his evil twin Set. And when you read my work on the JFK assassination and the role of Officer Tippett and the use of his body as the double of President Kennedy, you see how far and how deep this conspiracy was. And whenever people hear the word conspiracy now, they kind of have an aversion to it because the word has been so demeaned. But I point out to people, the word conspiracy exists because the act existed before the word was formed. And the word is in the dictionary because the act continues to be executed, conducted. And it seems that a great and successful psychological program has been conducted to have people have an adverse reaction instantly to hear the word conspiracy. And yet the United States government every day is indicting people on conspiracy of this and conspiracy of that, but not on the real conspiracies that are really most important to all of us, like the looting
about
of the treasury. You know?
The pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
If you wish, I can go on about Mars and the cataclysm, because now that was intuition, what I was talking about in 1997. But in 2003, Mars came closest to the Earth than it had in 60,000 years. And I've been an amateur astronomer for 25 years. You know, I've been on rooftops, 24 stories up in New York City with high-quality telescopes in the middle of winter, freezing my butt off with my buddy, just to get glimpses of the heavenly bodies through a really stable atmosphere. Because when the air is cold, it doesn't move about as much, so you don't have as much distortion. But this sighting of Mars didn't happen in winter. It happened in August. But it was the most wonderful August nights. For three nights in a row, we had perfectly clear skies. And as this was coming, and my buddy with the telescope had moved to Westchester, I was in a lurch, and something kept saying, "Robert, you cannot miss this. You cannot pass this up. You better get a telescope." So I went hunting around, and I bought a like $1,000 telescope for $700 or so, maybe a little less. And I thought, "Oh, God is with me. You know, I'm going to get to see it." So there I was, August 26th, 27th, and 28th of 2003, and I see Mars coming. And my God, in one eyeball full, I said, "My God, they've been lying to us for years." You know, because in one eyeball full, I saw Mars has an atmosphere, Mars has weather, Mars has clouds 2,000 miles long that roll off like barrels off the Tarsus highlands. The Tarsus bulge is this uplifting of Mars that occurred like the Palisades. In New York, we have these cliffs on the Hudson River that are called the Palisades. They're a couple of hundred feet high. And these Palisades on Mars, they run for thousands of miles from north to south, but they look like they're hundreds of miles high. And the Valles Marineris, this crack, the Grand Canyon-type crack in Mars, 4 miles deep, 18 miles wide at places, but it's also on a highland that descends very steeply off an area called Syria into this area called Sinai. And I realized when I saw the eye of Mars. Now, what is the eye of Mars? For over 100 years, astronomers looking at the planet Mars at certain times of the year, in certain phases, have seen this huge black spot in the center of Mars appear that makes Mars look like an eyeball. And so it was called the Eye of Mars. But this was Percival Lowell and those people, you know, in the early years were looking at it. And so it got this name, Eye of Mars, along with the canals. You know, the canals would appear seasonally. And so people thought, oh, you know, it might be something, vegetation that grows some time of the year. Well, anyway, the Eye of Mars turns out to be an effect created by a gigantic depression in Mars called Solus Locus. Solus Locus appears like a big pupil, and that's what it appeared like to me, except that it tapers down into a long black stream, and it looks like Alice Cooper's eye. You know Alice Cooper's eye? Right, with the big black tear coming down?
Yeah.
Well, here I am watching Mars, and I see it, and this was over a course of an hour and a half or so. So it was turned away from me and slowly rotating, slowly turning, and I'm looking, and all of a sudden this thing, this heavenly body turns, and I look through the telescope, and I see like an eyeball turning and looking down at me with this black tear running straight down like Alice Cooper's eye. And I was frightened because I realized in one sight, I said, oh, my God, something hit Mars so hard. It gouged out this crater that's 1,000 miles or more wide and maybe 1,500 miles or more north to south. And it's so deep that the sunlight in the morning, as the sunlight comes across Mars, this thing is so deep that the sunlight cannot reach the bottom of it until, I would say, 10:30 or 11 o'clock of the Martian day. So NASA's been lying to us about the depth of Solis Locus. It's been lying to us about the existence of an atmosphere, because the next day I got on my computer and they had released what they call the Hubble telescope photo of Mars, and it was total BS. It was a dehanced photograph of Mars. It was a cartoonized picture. They had stripped the air glow, they had stripped the atmosphere, they had stripped the weather. All of it had been removed. Mars has, you know, we have an aurora borealis.
Uh-huh.
Mars has an aurora australoborealis. It is plasma jets that stream from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere back and forth. And I saw all of these things with the naked eye through my telescope on the night that Mars came closest to the Earth in 60,000 years. I saw an ice mountain, an ice mountain peak in the south pole of Mars, which was like a spike. It was like an icicle. And when I looked at the picture that NASA had released, they had conveniently put a big white arrow right over the place where the spike mountain should appear. And it points and it says, South Pole. As if I didn't know. You know? So this is the disinformation technology. You mentioned that. I coined that phrase myself to express the use of disinformation, but not just disinformation in words. Disinformation technology is lying with pictures, the way we were lied to with the Kennedy photographs, the covering up of lunar ruins and artifacts, the airbrushing out that's been reported by so many NASA, former NASA employees, as part of the cover-up. But in that moment, I saw it, because I saw it with my naked eye, and the next morning I saw a totally stripped down dead picture of a living planet. So I do have a grudge against NASA, because I hate people who lie to me. Lying has effect on me. It makes me sick to be lied to, and it makes me sick to voice a lie. So I avoid it like the plague.
Well, I'm sure most of us, at least on this show,
will
stand with you on that one.
Yeah.
I have to ask, before, you know, so if there was a civilization on Mars, where did they come from, ultimately? I mean, I think I know what the answer is, and I think that you know what I'm asking for.
Well, you know, the prevalence of the seven stars is another symbol that recurs throughout sacred literature, seems to indicate to me a Pleiadian origin or relationship to the Pleiades. And but there are many, many races. I mean, you know, one of the biggest fakes that NASA pulled on us over the last 40 years is what I call the fake Drake equation, which was the equation to calculate, estimate the probability of intelligent life in the universe. And it was a really great ploy, because every time you came to FP, you know, the frequency of planets able to bear life, you came up with a zero. And any time you came up with a zero in that equation, you were at the dead end. But lo and behold, all of a sudden, technology advanced, and they're finding that planetary systems seem to be a natural occurrence of stellar formation and stellar evolution. And now we're up to the discovery of hundreds, if not thousands, of planets scattered across solar systems. So the Drake equation has backfired on NASA, because it was pretty cool, you know, when they could pull out the Drake equation out of their pocket and say, you see, you know, frequency of stars of this magnitude, frequency of stars with planetary system, frequency of planets capable of harboring life. Anytime the planets were zero, either, you know, they hadn't discovered any other planets then, right? So you had a zero there, and then you had to have a zero for planets that could maintain life. So it was a dead-end equation. It worked very well until we've just started to discover hundreds of planets circling other stars. And now the Drake equation affirms that it's very likely that that life may be evolving in hundreds, if not thousands or millions of places throughout solar systems. So that's disinformation technology, the airbrushing of photos out of the lunar research archives, whether they were Apollo, lunar orbiters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they just airbrush them out, black them out. But that they never conceived that we, the average American, would have at our fingertips, at our disposal, the use of computers which dwarf in magnitude the computers that NASA was using in the old days. It never occurred to them that we would be able to have access to the same technology they were using to cover up the truth, that we would have access to the same instruments to be able to uncover the truth. So while I'm sad that the space shuttle era is over, I'm glad that NASA is being dismembered. NASA and Nazi have the same root. They were born out of Nazi thinking. The Central Intelligence Agency takes its name from a German organization called the Mittelwerk, which was conceived in Hitler's office with Himmler, von Braun, Albert Speer, and all of them amalgamating intelligence operations and rocketry into one system. That became the Mittelwerk, Mittelwerk in German, the Central Works. Okay, so the Central Works became this Trojan horse which you imported after World War II through Operation Paperclip. And the tragedy is that we imported a Nazi virus into our science. And that Nazi virus has spread and has become the standard operating procedure of American science and infiltrated academia. So that's what we're up against. And it's like a robot. You know, the old geezers, the Nazis that we imported have died. I'm a little irreverent, so I say they've croaked. But their frogs, their robots are still croaking. You see, they taught a methodology to our scientists, and our scientists don't realize they're Nazis, but they're doing everything the way they were taught by Nazis how to do it, including lying to the public, hiding the funding. Oh, it's a long, long story.
Robert, this is Lavendar, and you told me a story today that really touched me, and if you would share it with our audience. It was about finding out that your friend had died, and that story that led up to that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I am I'm a spiritualist, shaman, necromancer. Necromancer is a person who has communication with the dead. Okay? And I've been visited too many times by ghosts who come to say goodbye to deny their existence. You know, I have a kinship with the spirit world, and very often when people die with a problem, unfinished business, I am approached by spirits, by ghosts, to try to help them find peace. But this one was already a peaceful person. Well, the story is this. On Easter Saturday of 2007, I had a vision or a dream in which I found myself on another planet, a huge planet, a life-supporting planet, Earth-like, but huge. It was in the night that I saw it, and I was in this on this planet where there was no really full night because it was so close to the belt stars of Orion that the belt stars hung in the sky like Hollywood Klieg lights. So there was never a complete darkness, a complete night. So in this twilight, I was aware that I was no longer on Earth and that I was really, really close to Orion. And I turned and someone summoned me into a chamber. And I walked into this chamber and it was a long oval room. And at the other end of the room was this very, very old, old lady. It seemed to me like an old mother something. I don't know. She was really powerful, but she was really still and she was just watching everything. And she her ideas guided me in the room. And the room had only two things. It was a table and there was a basket. And I was directed to go to the basket. And I went to the basket, and an angel appeared and gave me the basket and said, "Here, you're to guard this." So I looked in, and there was an egg, and the egg was cracked. And I looked really closely, and the crack was rather large, but the sac, the amniotic sac, was still intact. And I said to the angel, "Oh, God, the egg is cracked, but the bird is still alive. If we just watch it, it's going to hatch." She said, "That's what you're supposed to do, just guard it." So she handed me the basket, and so I didn't want to stand around holding the basket for a long time. So I said, "Let me just put it over here on the table, it'll be quite safe here." So I put it down. Then the angel said to me, "Would you like to dance?" I said, "Of course." "Well, sure, of course." And she embraced me, and I had this experience that is described by Robert Monroe in his book, Journeys Out of the Body, which is a spiritual communion of souls where you merge, and it's ecstatic, it's beautiful, it's romantic, it's beyond any concept of sex that we could have because it's true communion, soul to soul. So then we danced like that for a while, and then we parted, and I said, "Let's go check on the egg." So I looked, I got the basket, and the egg hatched, and out jumped this tiny, tiny white crane. And this white crane jumped up and I caught it in my hand and I brought it to my eye and I looked really closely at the long beak and it was a white crane with blue eyes and I looked at it and I said, "Oh my God, I hope this isn't a message." Because I can reflect in my lucid dreams and visions. I said, "Oh, I hope this isn't a message that somebody's going to die. It sure looks like Susan, you know, and the energy of this little bird was like my friend Susan, who I describe as a fairy. She was a performance artist, a graphic artist, a sculptor. She used to dance in New York City. She would dress in a tutu with fairy wings and a little fairy wand, and she'd go out and dance and cheer up people, and she did it all over the world. So she was called the Tutu Fairy. So I looked at this, and I said, "Oh, my God, it looks like Susan. I hope she's all right." So then I woke up and I kind of basically was mystified. It was very beautiful. It was so vivid. And about a week later, I get a call from her mother, and she says, "Robert, my name is Phyllis, and I met you at a party with my daughter Susan." And it was just matter of fact. And she says, "Well, I'm going to just tell you, Susan passed away. She was down in Mexico, and she caught a virus, and I had to go down there and get her, and I brought her back to Cornell Medical Center, but she had a heart seizure, and she passed away, and we're planning a commemoration for her sometime in June, and I'll let you know." So there I was really stunned, you know. I was really stunned that she died, but then I realized, God, you know, she was such a good friend. She thought enough of me to reach out to me. But the other thing about it was that I was the navigator. I was the guardian of this egg, and I navigated along with that angel to take this egg where the soul would hatch. During the interim, while waiting for the commemoration, I was going through my books on Chinese art symbols, and I found a sculpture of Lao Tzu, the founder of the Way, and holding in his hand an egg, but the egg was cut away, and inside was a white crane. So I read the article or the caption on it, and it says, Lao Tzu is shown holding an egg. Inside is a white crane, which is a symbol of the higher soul. So basically that Susan had arrived in this place where her higher soul could be born, reborn, and give flight. Now, the commemoration occurs in June 11th of that year in Central Park, and I felt obliged to tell this story. So I related the story about being on this place and the three belt stars of Orion and seeing her reborn and very happy, ecstatic, couldn't wait to fly. I mean, she was just so excited. She couldn't wait to fly. Didn't have enough feathers, but that's why she jumped out of my hand and onto the floor. So I tell the story, and then I sat down, and everybody was kind of mystified, you know. Next person up is a gentleman named Armstrong, who was an African-American, one-quarter German, a very unusual man with green eyes. And I recognized him, you know, this guy is really special, you know. So he goes up and he starts telling the story. He's an artist, and he met Susan in Mexico in December of the year before, and he had been painting on the beach in Mazunta. So Susan, very friendly girl, and also an artist, walks up, hey, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm painting the Milky Way. He said, Milky Way, where is that? He said, she didn't know the Milky Way. So I pointed out the Milky Way, and I pointed out the three belt stars of Orion. And I said to her, who can break the belt stars of Orion? Quoting from the classics, he said, meaning, who can get there? So they both came back to the United States, and then he said, the last time I saw Susan was in late January, and she came up to me in the street, and she said, hey, Armstrong, guess what? I'm going back to Mazunta. I'm going back to the beach where you showed me the three belt stars of Orion. Oh, I'm overwhelmed because when he said that, coupled with my relating the story, that put everything together, and it really transformed the afternoon. And I'm very, very grateful. Now, I'll add this. I didn't tell you this earlier today when we had our conversation, but I had a second visitation from her, and that occurred in August of the same year. And this is a very strange event because I was in a totally black sleep. Black sleep is a totally unconscious, dreamless state when all of a sudden the phone starts ringing at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, oh, my God, who's calling me at 3 o'clock in the morning? I'm so tired, and the phone keeps ringing, and I feel like comatose, you know, half asleep, half awake, not wanting to be awake, half paralyzed, can't move. And by the way, folks, when you have this state, this sleep paralysis, the only thing you have is your breath. And I've learned this over years. And the way to break the sleep paralysis is to take a deep, deep breath and yell, Albert, or Albert. And that blast of sound coming through your throat reverberates through the musculature of the throat and breaks the paralysis. And so I did that, and I bolted upright. And as soon as I bolted upright, the phone stopped ringing. I fell back in the bed, a street light coming in from in New York City. You know, I'm not in the dark. It's actually close, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. It's supposed to be dark, but New York is never dark. And so I lie back, and all of a sudden, I saw this beautiful, translucent blue butterfly on the ceiling near my light fixture. And I see it fluttering in slow, slow motion descending. And it took about 15 seconds, and I'm saying to myself, I have a hallucination. I'm in the half sleep, and I'm half in the dream state, half in the wake state. Okay, and I watch it, and this beautiful butterfly flutters down to my bureau, and I say, it was big. If you put your two hands together and join them at the thumbs, that's how big this thing was. And I said to myself, well, you know, I could get up and go over there, but I don't think I really want to find a one-foot diameter butterfly over there. I think I'm just going to go to sleep. I just let this rest, you know? So it was a very powerful experience. I wrote to a friend of mine in British Columbia, who's a detective, a very dear friend, and I told her about this, and I told her Susan's name, and her name was Susan Smolinski. So she goes and does a detective thing looking for who is Susan Smolinski. And what she sent me back was, she said, look what I found. I found a sculpture by your friend Susan Smolinski, and it's a sugar butterfly. She had made a butterfly out of crystal sugar that was translucent. You could see through it. And the picture arrives, and I'm going, oh, my Lord. You know, life is strange, life is wonderful. Who could have known that? I didn't know that, but my detective friend goes around, and Susan got into food art, and one of her beautiful things was this glazed sugar butterfly. And so I feel that, you know, she was close to me, she was a very dear friend, and that she hovered, and she's, you know, the ghosts, the spirits, they do not leave, they rest. But the people who love you are still there. And when they need you or you need them, they extend themselves. We are all protected by spirits, the spirits of our loved ones. We're also assailed by our enemies. You know, there are evil spirits, and I've had to contend with them as well, both in dealing with their approaching me, but in also in harassing other people. So part of the work I do as a psychotherapist is to help people deal with their psyche. The psyche is a soul, you see. It's not the mind. The soul is a very different thing than the mind. And it's gotten muddled, you know, so in our society. So I use all of my skills, and I use Tai Chi, Taoist meditation, Qigong, yoga, to help people relieve themselves of the stresses, the trauma that is imposed on them by any number of things. Post-traumatic stress syndrome can be from something like Hurricane Katrina, an earthquake, but it can just as easily be the result of extraterrestrial abduction, or an experience with a ghost or a demon or jinns. And I think that this vocabulary that I've just expressed is really a cover story for a phenomenon that's been on this planet since time immemorial and has been working with and against man for millennia.
Well, it's all about discernment.
Yes.
And you know, trying to put it together and make sense, or at least resonate or not resonate.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't make sense out of it,
then that's the difficult part of remote viewing, in that out-of-body experiences, lucid dreaming or remote viewing, your soul is presenting to you an awareness of coming events, but the coming event has not yet manifested, and so the thing that it does is it tries to approximate the closest life experience that you have had already and presents the warning, the premonition, in such terms, hoping that you will be able to extend and refine it and understand what it's relating to. The one thing I will say about remote viewing and encountering other people or entities or beings is that the eyes do not change. That's the one thing. Everything else, the person's persona may be disguised, their personality, their gender, their race, but the eyes, as they appear to you in a dream or lucid dream or remote viewing, out-of-body experience, that's the thing to remember, because that's how you'll recognize the person or entity when they come into your life days or weeks or hours later. But it's a skill that has to be developed.
Yeah, I was just going to say that if you, it's not something to play around with. You know, well, you really have to have a guided, someone that really like you. If someone were interested in doing that, I wouldn't recommend going out by yourself without any kind of training ahead of time.
That's why actually I do have a manual that I use to train people, and it's Robert A. Monroe's book Out of Body, Journeys Out of the Body. That's a book that helped me. I had this gift, like you and many other people who are listening. I'm sure you are aware of it. I think it's a natural aspect of human consciousness, and it's actually the more important one that kept that's helped man survive for 1.5 million years. You know, the verbal brain only began to develop about 10,000 years ago. But something guided us, protected us, sheltered us, warned us, and I believe these two faculties are instinct and intuition. And instinct and intuition have been turned in by modern science into something they call superstition. But they were there long before science emerged, and mankind was guided out of Africa and back again and out again by instinct and intuition, not science, logic, and verbal thinking. Look at a cat. I admire cats. I have two wonderful cats, Lancelot and Galahad. And he's long series of 40 years of cats who have turned, who have trained me in many ways and turned me into a very cat-like individual in that I try to move like a cat. And a cat moves the way he does because he's really true to himself. A cat does not have a false self-image. A cat does not have an ego the way we have egos. But a cat has a mind of its own. It has survived on this planet as long as mankind has. And it never thinks a word. It makes its decisions non-verbally. It has instinct. It has intuition. One of the things that marvels me about cats is the hard wiring of their understanding of geometry. Like my kittens, when, you know, I don't like to be awakened in the morning by cats. You know, I love cats, but I like my sleep. But when I had these kittens, I shuttered them out. And they were able to figure out how to climb, as kittens, how to climb bookshelves, jump across curtains, jump into skylights, from the skylight leap onto my bed because they wanted to be next to me. And that is amazing to me, that we have this vast and ancient body of knowledge, just like the cat does, but it's not... It has actually been suppressed. You see, science has suppressed these faculties, dubbing them superstition and worse, you know, as, in order to maintain its hold on us. One of my favorite ditties that I invented is this one. It says, "The first trick of science was to convince you that you evolved from a monkey so that when they treat you like a monkey, you won't complain." But I'm also a religious person, and I believe that there is a divine guidance and a divine plan, and that sometimes even a punk rock band like Devo can have an insight. You remember Devo? They were from Akron, Ohio in the 80s. They were like the vanguard of the punk rock band. They wrote a song called Jocko Homo, which I also like to quote, the chorus, and it says, "You walk like an ape, you talk like an ape, you do like the monkeys do. God made man, but the monkeys provided the glue." Which leads me now back to Mars. Okay? The Martian remnant, right? The cataclysm that shattered Mars. There's another crater on Mars called the Hellas Basin. The night before I saw the eye on Mars, the eye of Mars, I saw the Hellas Basin. And again, that night, I knew that NASA was lying, because the Hellas Basin came around, the planet was revolving, and I saw this smoking, unbelievable crater. It was smoking and exuding gas, and it was terraced. It was huge. It was hundreds of miles wide, And I actually saw the terracing of the sides of the crater, and it reminded me of the Grand Canyon. But there was this very soupy fog that I called smoke that was coming out of it, and it was iridescent. It had rainbows glittering across the surface of it.
Oh, my goodness.
The next morning, I wrote up about it, and the next afternoon, I read a press release from NASA saying that they had discovered a vast ocean of CO2, carbon dioxide, in the Hellas Basin, and that the air pressure was so low in the Hellas Basin that it congealed into this permanent fog, basically dry ice, right? You know the fog coming off dry ice when you see it? Well,
right.
Basically that's what it was. And that the planetary winds of Mars rushing over it were creating this lid. So there was this high pressure on top and a low pressure in the basin, and so the basin is always bubbling with this trapped sea of CO2. And I had seen it with my own eyeballs. And
wow.
It was incredible, incredible. So Mars is a very vibrant, living, dynamic planet. You know how they talk? Here's some of the way the fallacies, you know, they defeat themselves. NASA, they give you these lies, and then they give you information which belies their lies, right? They say, you know, oh, the atmosphere on Mars is too thin. It's, you know, very rarefied atmosphere. The pressure is way low. There's hardly any atmosphere at all. And then they pull out these pictures of planetary-wide dust storms with winds racing at 200 miles an hour. How can you have a planetary-wide dust storm with winds racing at 200 miles an hour and scouring everything as if it was like sandpaper, sandblasted, if the atmosphere is so thin and almost not rarefied and non-existent? For a wind to blow at 200 miles an hour, the molecules have to be really compressed and tight. You know, you're not going to get a rarefied atmosphere blowing at 200 miles an hour. So the deception is vast and long, but people who know how to think can say, hey, you know, this doesn't make sense. How can there be no atmosphere? And then an upwelling, the dust is raised to stratospheric levels. That can't happen. It can't happen if there's no atmosphere. Then let's not even talk about the lightning and the aurora australoborealis or these unbelievable clouds. The clouds were rolling off these cliffs. The cliffs of the Tarsus Bulge runs north to south. So the winds of Mars are blowing over this flatland high, and then they fall off the cliff and they spin. And when they spin, what they do is they spin off and create low pressures, barrels of low pressure, which create these long columns of clouds. And I swear, they're 2,000 miles long, like logs after logs after logs. You know, if you've ever seen logs, you know, in a river,
uh-huh.
Imagine all of them parallel and rolling off this cliff, but they're all white and they're 2,000 miles long. So
wow.
A couple of days later, you know, this is the thing. I feel that NASA is often forced by my articles or my affirmations to come out and say, oh, you know what? We discovered that. And they come out with articles. You know what? They actually had the audacity. After I published The Four Faces of Mars, they had the audacity to try to deflect attention, and they put up a page, The Four Faces of Mars, and they put up four of their phony pictures of Mars taken by the Hubble Space Telescope.
Wow.
I'm really down on them.
Okay, well, Robert, this is just mostly fascinating for all of our audience and everyone. The one person that hasn't been able to come on and talk to you is our other co-host, Sierra. Sierra, would you like to say something to Robert at this time?
Well, I sure would. Thank
you
so
Sarah.
Much. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Pretty good.
I'm so happy that you're here. And I got mixed feelings about it because I've been nothing but angry since you've been talking about all this stuff.
Oh, my.
It's a good
thing.
I'm just joking. Okay. I just, you know, the audacity of the government and the audacity of NASA to continually try to keep information from the people is what angers me.
Yeah.
And I want to address what your, what do you encourage people to do? What kinds of actions can people take in their own towns and their own governments and their own whatever? I mean, how do you deal ongoingly with this information and knowing that they're just purposefully out there continuously trying to debunk all the information that you have and that is constantly coming out? How do you deal with that?
Well, I basically take arms against it. I do research. I exchange information with networks of people. I encourage people to support other people's research and to disseminate it, actually, you know, to become part of a network like you are with Starseed Radio, and I am with, you know, scores and scores of UFO groups and spiritual development, evolution groups. Just keep sending the information around, challenge it. I'm very proud to say that I met Timothy Leary in my lifetime, and he made a wonderful, wonderful tape or video DVD just before he died, and it's called How to Operate Your Brain. And he gives some really good advice. Challenge authority, think for yourself. Learn how to operate your brain, because if you don't, someone else will. And that's the basis of mind control. And I work every day to liberate myself from patterning, mind control patterning. Some of it is social, like political correctness, a big drag. And others of it is religious indoctrination, you know, to accept blindly the dogmas of whatever religion. But you have to analyze your own thinking. And really, you know, I find that many people are running around thinking thoughts that really are not their own, but they do take them to be their own, which is, you know, like the mind control about the NASA picture of the face on Mars, that I myself was subjected to mind control. But I broke out of it when I realized, hey, was that really my thought? When I looked at the picture, I said to myself, oh, my God, it's only a rock. But then when I heard everybody else saying it's only a rock, I said, uh-oh, I know what this is. This is Gestalt psychology. Because Gestalt psychology was developed in Germany in the 1920s. And unlike Freudian psychology or Jungian psychology, which deals with the upwellings of the human mind and your dreams and your anxieties reflected in dreams, as Freud likes to think. Gestalt psychology went into the field of studying of how an idea is formed in the human brain, how a human organizes information to create a thought. Well, they figured that out, and as a result, the Nazis were able to take that psychology and reverse engineer it. And by that I mean this. They were able to produce posters supporting Nazism or extolling Hitler that produced a reaction in individuals where they would all have the same thought at the same time and think it was their thought. You see what I mean?
Yes.
That's mind control. And that happened to me when I looked at this picture. And I was depressed. And that's what happens when mind control is used on you and a lie is foisted on you and you fall for it. You have a psychological and emotional reaction which makes you feel a little uneasy, because your brain and my brain is an instrument designed to discern the truth. And when it discerns the truth, there is ecstasy. And when it discerns a lie, there is depression. And this is actual electrical voltage changes that do occur in the brain. And so you have to analyze.
So is this what keeps people sort of paralyzed with and continually accepting this type of brainwashing or this type of implanting or this type of mind control.
Yeah, neurolinguistic programming is a part of it, too. It's a big part of it now. Weasel wording. And, yes, people are dumbfounded. It results in a state of mind called cognitive dissonance. And this state leads you into a kind of paralysis of action and numbness because you don't know what to think. And that was perfected. The methodology was perfected in the John F. Kennedy assassination and the other assassinations that followed, the Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy, all of them. They have this hallmark. Why is it always a lone nut? Where was that lone nut before he went lonely, you know? I'm sure he wasn't.
That's, gotcha.
You know what I mean?
I appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. People think they're not susceptible to mind control. It's, oh, nobody could hypnotize me. Nobody can do mind control on me. Well, I'll say to that person, hey, have you ever had a jingle or a limerick or a song in your head that you couldn't get out of your head? I think that's happened to everybody.
Yes.
Well, folks, you were under mind control. You weren't in control of your own mind. A thought was rambling through in a loop, and you couldn't control it. Now, how it got there is anybody's guess, but I would guess also that it's probably intentional. That's the intention behind limericks, jingles, slogans, to embed themselves in your brain, in your thinking process, and make you think that you're really humming that song because you like it. Well, I don't think so.
So we all have this that we're dealing with. We have this inherited conversation. We have social and religious conversations, all these different things that we've inherited. And I know that there are a lot of starseeds, a lot of people out there raising their consciousness level, but at some point there has to be action consistent with taking back our sovereignty.
Sure. Absolutely.
How can we do that in a peaceful way without engaging the same thing over and over again?
Well, I think that what has to be done is our society has to be re-engineered, and we have to do it from the local level up. I've written off all the gangsters in government. I don't believe a word that comes out of Washington. I don't believe any of the politicians. There is a hidden agenda overriding everything. And the lies are blatant, the cover-ups, the distractions are evident, and we have to organize ourselves from the local level. You have to network with people of like mind, people of like values, and nurture each other, help each other. As time goes by, this will be your support network. These will be the people that you can rely on, that you can turn to. For me, 9/11 really changed my life for many reasons. But basically, it turned my value system to my home, my family, my loved ones. That's who is important. That comes first. And everything else is secondary or a distraction. And we have to break away from the mind control instrumentalities, which are the news feeds that people listen to. You know, if you look at CNN and watch what they call news for an hour and a half, you will see that there was really only about 35 minutes of news. The rest was commercials. And then for the rest of the day, they rehash and rehash and rehash. And you are people, or myself included, are subjecting ourselves to this repetition. And that repetition of false information creates habituation. You get used to it, and you accept it. But the other part is, how many hours of life are we wasting listening to this over and over and over again? So I've disciplined myself to just, I turn it on to see what they're foisting on the people, you know, for an hour and a half. As soon as that story comes on again, I change it, and I turn it off. The other thing is that there's a background noise to these newscasts, which create an irritating vibration. It's kind of like It's a vibration in a background noise that creates disharmony. It's not
it's
peaceful.
A very specific and megahertz that they use.
Yes,
to
exactly.
Actually,
it creates a constant level of anxiety. My lady is very sensitive to it, and often she'll say, please turn off the television. I can't stand this. I don't want to hear this. And as soon as I flick that thing off, this calm and this peace comes over the room, the people, the household. And I would ask you to do these experiments. Turn on these different, sensationalist news stations and stand there for a while, and don't pay attention to what they're saying, but just pay attention to the atmosphere you're standing in. And then just turn off the volume and then watch the pictures. And then bring up the volume again and experience what you're feeling somatically in your body, your skin, your head, your ears. And then turn it off again. And you'll see that more often than not, you're going to start turning that television thing off for longer and longer periods of time. And then you will have that time will be your own. See, we are wasting millions and millions of human hours, man and woman hours, exposing ourselves to these bad vibes. The other thing is the malice that I see in commercials, making us laugh at the pain of others. That's un-American to me,
Yes.
Manipulating, situations, contriving situations where the embarrassment or the injury of another is made a comical thing. And that is very bad for you, because what it's doing is it's hardening your heart and it's hardening your feelings to other people's suffering.
It's desensitization.
Yes,
yep.
Exactly. Yeah.
They use that a lot in the military. I was in the Army for 8 years, and so
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of programs they use consistently through it all.
Yeah.
But thank you for answering that question. I do have another question, taking it away back to the Mars.
Sure.
Do you believe that, because there's, some sensationalized things on YouTube and the Internet, that those clouds and those things that you saw with your own eyes
mm-hmm.
would be our government actually terraforming Mars and preparing Mars, or possibly even having an underground base on Mars, or
mm-hmm.
something that has to do with preparing Mars again to be inhabitable for
mm-hmm.
The overpopulation of Earth, or just
mm-hmm.
just whatever it is that...
Mm-hmm.
Did you see any evidence of that, or do you feel...
No, I don't think that what I saw... I thought what I saw was natural. One of the certifications that I have is I'm a certified weather specialist by the U.S. government. I took tests and examinations, and I'm a pretty good weatherman, and I know how weather is formed. So I can tell you that what I saw of those columnar clouds that were thousands of miles long rolling off the Tarsus Highlands was not terraforming. That was just natural Martian topographical effects creating weather. I don't think that we have the power to create an aurora borealis from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere of Mars. But I don't doubt that those plans, theoretically, are about. I don't doubt that we or some other entities may already have manned bases on Mars and the Moon. They may not be Earth manned bases, but I believe that Mars and the Moon are populated. See,
perfect.
Going back to the Drake equation and the other debunking tricks of NASA, one of the big debunking tricks of NASA is the hypothesis. It's kind of like a weird reverse logic. And it supposes that the ET, the entities that we call ETs, come from other stars. Okay, so it says, oh, here's the rationale. Oh, stars are so far apart, and it's so impossible for anyone, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, to exceed the speed of light. It's impossible for any of them to have come here from other stars. So that being so, it's impossible that extraterrestrial exists. Well, I say, well, that's all fine and dandy, But what if they're local yokels? What if we're dealing with parallel evolution of life strains, different life strains that have been evolving, co-evolving, in this solar system? And one of the great candidates for a place where a different form of life may have been evolving and may be evolving is Titan, the moon of Saturn. And it see, the media doesn't, when great discoveries are made that challenge the status quo, the media will report it with a little ticker tape that goes across the bottom of the screen and then ignore the story. And the biggest story as far as evolution and DNA is concerned of the last year is the discovery of an arsenic-based life form that was discovered in Mono Lake by NASA researchers and announced at the end of last year. That is the biggest thing in creation. They found a form of DNA that's bound by a molecule of arsenic, and ours are bound by phosphorus. So this arsenic-based DNA life form, it has to struggle here on Earth because the heat of Earth breaks down the arsenic very quickly, so it has to. This life form is always struggling to replenish arsenic, so it can only live in a place like Mono Lake, some volcanic lake in California. But the point made by these scientists, and something that really registered deeply in me, is that they went out of their way to point out that this kind of life form might thrive on another planet or planetoid or a place. And they specifically cited this kind of life form might thrive on a place like Titan, major moon of Saturn. Now, why is that significant to me? Because I read an MJ-12 document and some papers related to Project Sign and Project Grudge, which was before Blue Book. And one of these documents stated that in the early 1950s, the United States government had found that great ships, motherships, had taken equatorial orbits around Earth, and they were dropping off the so-called flying saucers, the scout ships that zip in and come and do the local work. And so they enlisted the major astronomy observatories and the major astronomers like Donald Menzel of Harvard, and they enlisted them to track the flights of these fleets of motherships to see where they were coming and going. And the report stated that these UFO motherships were tracked by high-power telescopes, the best ones we had, and that they were coming and going from Saturn's moon Titan.
Wow.
And Huygens,
what species do, if you could just, you know, gander at that, you know, using your extra sensory perception, is what?
I think it's the grays.
The grays, okay.
Yeah, I believe the grays' homeland or home base in the solar system may be Titan, and that they also have a base on the far side of the moon.
Yes.
Yeah,
do you know anything about the feline type extraterrestrials that have been interacting with people here on Earth? Are you familiar with them and have any knowledge of them?
I don't have any direct personal knowledge of them, except that I feel one. I mentioned my career in Tai Chi, and I've said 40 years in martial arts. And the first martial art that I studied was called the Black Tiger Kung Fu. And this is a very powerful shamanic form of kung fu. And it's so powerful that it seemed at times to me to be like possession. And I had to leave it for that reason, because I felt that it was tripping something in me that was very animalistic, very ferocious. And later on, when I related this to Richard Hoagland, his eyes popped up and he said, "Wow, have you ever heard of the feline gene?" I said, no. He says, well, humans share, you know, several genes with cats, and they call it feline genes. And it seems to me that these exercises and kung fu that you were practicing was awakening that feline gene. And to be honest with you, it did feel like possession by a ferocious tiger. I mean, it took every ounce of willpower at times to restrain the beast, you know. And thank God Tai Chi came along. Tai Chi masters found me around that time, and they saw some, I guess I like to say, they saw a good chunk of marble that they could carve into something better, and I was invited to become a disciple of the highest ranking grandmaster in Tai Chi Chuan of the Yang family, was Professor Cheng Manqing, and that was around 1972 and 73. And I've been at it ever since then. So next year will be my 40th anniversary in Tai Chi. And my Kung Fu career began in 1969 and 70. But the thing that drew me to Kung Fu, which was actually Praying Mantis Kung Fu, was the first thing I saw. And I thought all Kung Fu was Praying Mantis. So I went into this Tiger Claw school. I heard it was a really great school and a great grandmaster. And my buddy said, hey, let's join together. So I went in and I started learning the Fu Jiao Pai, or the Black Tiger Claw system. And about 3 months later, I said to one of the Chinese fellows, hey, when do we learn the Praying Mantis? He says, what? What are you talking about? You're not going to learn Praying Mantis here. I said, why? I thought it was that's Kung Fu, but that's another school. You want to learn Praying Mantis, you got to go to a Praying Mantis school. So
that's so great.
That's how dumb I was.
Just
anyway,
one more. Thank you, Robert, so much.
I noticed the time, and we haven't been able to let any of our listeners ask questions.
Oh,
so maybe we
go right ahead.
Right.
We've got 15 minutes. So Ariel, why don't
you
see who is online to ask Robert a question.
Okay, well, we're going to go to the chat room first. So, Purple Sage, here we come. Hello.
Hello.
Hi,
oh,
do we have any questions?
I have got a bucket load of questions here. Everybody is so excited about Robert. First question, everybody's wondering, Robert, do you have a website?
I write for UFO Digest, as well as being editor there. And most of my ufology and my work in that realm, ETAP, extraterrestrials, and Mars, a lot of my work is there. My JFK research is archived at jfkresearch.com. And that's intimately connected to all of these things that we're discussing. President Kennedy was very interested in UFOs and the extraterrestrial phenomenon, was trying to get the word out, and that was one of the several reasons that he was assassinated. See, the threat to science is overwhelming. Science has established itself as a religion that has placed man in God's position. And all of a sudden, we're confronted with an intelligence far higher, far older than we are, and one that may have had a hand in our own development. So the admission by science that we humans are really not at the top of the food chain, you might say, is a very disturbing thing. And that's the reason, you know, the study was done in 1967 as to whether or not to reveal to people if we discovered intelligent life in outer space. And the Brookings Institution said, no, it will cause economic upheaval and the collapse of religious beliefs and chaos and distress. And they said that the most affected would be doctors and scientists who might not be able to get out of bed in the morning the next day to go to work when confronted with the awesome prospect of having to catch up with some intelligence that's 300, 500 years ahead of us. So it's to protect themselves, not the public.
Right.
They're quashing the stories, you know.
Okay, yeah, we'll try to get through as many questions as we can.
Sure, I'll try to be brief.
Because we only have 10 minutes left here.
Okay.
Okay, and You had mentioned earlier in a statement for those who believe that we are from the stars or whatever. What is your belief?
Well, I know that every molecule in my body came out of the sun. And I also believe that we have encoded in our DNA something deeper than DNA. I would call it atomic memory. I believe that even the atoms in our bodies are repositories of information and knowledge that that came right out of the sun. So we are all star children, although some of us may not remember it or feel it yet. And I think that that's what's going to happen in 2012. I think that DNA is going to start to unfold and awaken in an individual a recollection of his true nature and his, her true identity. I know we're short on time, so I don't really want to go on, but I had an experience of that listening to Graham Hancock tell the story of Sir Francis Crick discovering DNA. And Sir Francis Crick confessed on his deathbed two things, that he wasn't drinking malt ale on the night he discovered DNA. He was doing acid. And the other thing he said was that the chances of a human DNA evolving naturally on this planet according to the rules of chance and evolution are about as likely as a tornado moving through a junkyard and leaving behind a perfectly formed 747. So he went on to say that Sir Francis Crick believed that some ancient civilization foresaw its doom and sent out probes packed with bacteria and sent it in all directions, hoping that it would seed someplace. So the panspermia theory is part of it, and that he believed that we really are, star stuff, and came from a far ancient, more ancient civilization. And when Graham Hancock told that story, I had been suffering from a severe injury. I was in agonizing pain from a hip injury and a knee twist that I had suffered, and I had hobbled to his lecture. And the moment he told that story, this ecstasy, euphoria, went up through every cell of my body as I remembered who I was. And this feeling of elation went through me and said, I knew I came from outer space and I'm going back. But you know what? The pain left. It was like an anesthesia. I was able to stand up, walk, and walk home. And I swear to God, it was almost like that story of Jesus and may I touch the hem of your garment. And it was so rapid. It was so strange. It was so ecstatic that I really have a lot of respect for Graham Hancock's shamanic powers. And I highly recommend his books to everyone.
Sounds so blissful, too.
Well, it's the company I'm keeping tonight, I think. You know, there is a resonance amongst us, and I really thank you very much for having me on, and I hope that I'm living up to your expectations and...
Well, I can tell you the switchboard is just packed full. So
well, let's see what we can get. I'll go for it.
And if I may say something, sure. There is a comment by several people, it looks like, in the chat that you should be a regular guest on this show.
Well, thank you very much.
They're loving you.
Thank you.
I think we can arrange that.
Well, we'll try.
Yeah.
Next
well,
question.
We have about 6 minutes, Purple Sage. Do we have more questions from the chat room?
We do have more, but did you want to give some of the callers a chance?
Let's go with the caller.
Yes, we can do that. We have most of the callers are simply listening.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Well, whichever way you want to go, I'm ready.
I do have more questions here.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. If we have time, now we only have 6 minutes left, and I don't want to take it right down to the wire, but let me pick up at least one call, and then we'll come back and have the question ready, okay, Purple Sage?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you so much. And I would like to mention that because Tammy's electricity never came back, so Purple Sage has been handling the switchboard and the chat and two chat rooms all by herself.
Wow.
So,
thank you.
Pat on the back there, girl. You're doing great. Thanks. Okay, I'll be back in a bit.
Yep.
Okay. Bye-bye. God, what we do without her. Okay, really, really quick now, I'm just going to pick up one call from Joseph. Joseph, how are you doing tonight? You're on the air.
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm flying high. Robert, thank you so much for all this information.
It's my pleasure.
I feel like we've been leading parallel lives. I lived in New York for 30 years. We must have walked past each other on the street.
I'm sure.
I want to share with you, I went to Egypt in 1988 with a group of 42 people, and we had this incredible tour guide who was so bright and so well-educated, so intelligent, and she looked at me and she said, my husband and my son are both named Yusuf. She said, so you and I have a very strong connection. So every time she'd say something, she'd make sure I was paying attention. And the one thing I remember so vividly is she said, Cairo is our name for the planet Mars.
Exactly. That's the one element I left out in my dissertation. Yes, I'm aware of that. Graham Hancock made me aware of that. But yes, even Cairo means Mars.
It does, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beyond coincidence. Joseph, we want to thank you so much for calling in, and I know that you probably have more to say, but we only have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to try to move on quickly and just try to keep up a couple more questions. So thank you, Joseph, for calling in.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
You too.
Bye-bye. Okay, we're going back to the chat room. Let me scroll down here. Purple Sage, we're back.
Yep. Okay. Howdy. I have three questions on Mars. Robert, what do you think happened to the civilization on Mars?
I believe that a cataclysm occurred in short order that disrupted Mars' life entirely. I believe that a remnant of it made it to Earth and seeded itself and crossed with proto-hominids and raised proto-hominids to a human stature. And I believe that that's the story that we get in Genesis and in the Book of Enoch. I also believe that there must have been a remnant that also survived on Mars and probably went underground in order to live, survive, thrive. And I think that the tubes, the glass tubes structures that Richard Hoagland discovered so many years ago and that keep cropping up in all parts of Mars are indicators that there may be a subterranean remnant on the planet Mars. That's what
okay.
I believe.
Well, thank you so much, Purple Sage. We are going to have to wrap up now because we just have 2 minutes, and I hate closing
okay.
the show in a rush. So
sure,
everyone in
sure.
the chat room, thank you so much, and we will we'll do our best to work out another appearance from Robert Morningstar. So
thank
Maureen,
you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much,
grateful.
Purple Sage.
Wonderful day.
And Lavendar. Lavendar is still on.
Yes.
And Sierra?
Yes, this has been a wonderful show, and I really want to say that all of us have to remember the Emerald Ray and to do particular exercises for the consciousness of this planet so it will be uplifted. Remember, it's only a step up. If you just step up all the time, and don't get caught in mind control, don't get caught in religion, or all the misinformation that's been given to us all these years. We have to create the new consciousness, and we're responsible for it. And the new kids that are coming, they depend on us to help them. And so that's my closing comment.
If I may say, I was totally enthralled by your reading, and I recommend your astrology reading to everyone. I was very impressed. I've had a few readings, but as you know from our conversation this afternoon, you are very, very insightful, and I do recommend your work to those who are listening.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, thank you so much, Robert, we do have to have you back when your schedule permits, and we promise that we will get that worked out.
Sure.
And it's just been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you
so much.
The pleasure was mine.
To Purple Sage and Sierra and Lavendar, this is Arielle Taylor. We all say good night and thank you so much. And we will be back next week at same time, same place, on Starseed Radio Academy. Thank you so much, everyone.
Good night.
Bye-bye, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.